and if anyone ever mentioned my name, even in passing. If it was a very long night, and sleep didn't come at all, I would let every guard down and think of Dennis. Perhaps he was sloped in one of Karen's low leather chairs by the millstone table, reading Walt Whitman and listening to some new recording on the gramophone, or in his storybook cottage at the Mutega, sipping at nice scotch, or off in the Congo, or in Maasai country, after ivory or kudu or lion, and looking up, just then, at the same tangle of stars I could see from my windows. How close people could be to us when they had gone as far away as possible, to the edges of the map. How unforgettable. Chapter 38. One morning, Pegasus and I rode out from Westerland to get supplies. I was hunched over the saddle in my buckskin coat, fingers cramping with cold, when I saw the canopy of a motor car folded and propped, throwing back chilly light. A man stood bent over the engine, wearing dungarees and moccasins much like my own. There weren't many motor cars in Molo, which was as far behind Nairobi in time as Nairobi was behind London. It was a difficult place to get to, the steep escarpment wanting to wall you out. It was a hard place to break down, too, so I knew I should help if I could. "Is there something I can do?" I called out from the saddle. "What's that?" He straightened from behind the canopy, wiping oil-blackened hands on an oil-blackened bit of cloth. He was young, I saw, with a sweep of almost black hair. His breath rose in puffs past thin lips and a dark, trimmed moustache. "You've got yourself into a spot here. I haven't given up yet. You must know about engines, then." "Not really, but I'm learning. This one seems to want to challenge me, to see if I'm serious." "I don't think I'd have much patience for that."
"You don't think this one tests you?"
He pointed at Pegasus.
I laughed and climbed down from my saddle, holding onto the reins. "We test each other," I conceded, "but that's more the natural order. Men and horses have lived together for centuries. I sometimes think the autos will all break down and be abandoned, and we'll find them like skeletons on the side of the road."
"That's a nice picture you're painting, but I predict it will go the other way. The auto is just the beginning, the tip of things. Men only want to go faster and feel freer. Pegasus is enough for me, thank you."
He smiled.
"Pegasus, eh? I'm sure he's very fast, but if you ever went up in an aeroplane, you'd swallow your words. And your heart as well, maybe."
I thought of Dennis and JC and Maya, each of them alive with the talk of flight. Above us in the sky there was nothing at all. Not even clouds.
"What's it like?"
"Like breaking through everything that ever wanted to rein you in. There are no barriers up there. Nothing to stop you from going on forever. All of Africa stretches out under you. It doesn't hold anything back or want to stop you."
"I might guess you're a poet."
"A farmer, actually."
He grinned.
"I have a little plot up near Eldama. What do you do around here?"
When I told him, we quickly put two and two together. He was Jerry's silent partner, Tom Campbell Black. He owned part of the Baron. "You've got a fine horse," I told him. "I'm banking he'll win something big come July. Maybe then you can buy that aeroplane."
"Can I hold you to that?"
He bent over the engine again and made a few last adjustments.
"Mind your horse. I'm going to give it a crank."
After half a dozen lurching wheezes, the engine clanked to life. I watched him fold the canopy and settle his tools in the boot while Pegasus stamped beneath me. He was cold. I was too.
"Good luck to you,"
I called out over the noisy churning of the motor, and we both waved goodbye. Within a few months, things in Molo took a turn without warning. One of the stable doors at Westerland had a rusty hinge,
and Melton Pye got out late one night and panicked somehow. She ended up tangled in some wire fencing, her barrel and cannons badly torn. She would recover, but the veterinary bill was shocking. George and Viola were furious and wanted to pin it on me. "How's a rusty hinge my fault?" I asked, when the two had me driven into a corner one night in their library at Inglewood.
"She was in your care," George railed. "You should be overseeing everything."
I looked at Jerry to back me up, but he only sat pinched in his chair, his neck flaring pink under the line of his trimmed beard.
"Perhaps you could offer to pay half, Beryl," he finally offered.
"With what? I live like a pauper, Jerry. You know that. And besides, why should I pay for her care? That's an owner's place. I certainly won't get a penny when she wins."
"She's won nothing," Viola said flatly.
"You haven't given me time."
"I can't see how we can take the risk now," George pronounced, folding his arms over his tight-fitting vest.
And so the matter was settled, and not in my favor. I would have to pay the fees, somehow, and the Carsdale Lux were letting me go. They would give me a week to find another place to live and clear off their property. I went back to my cold hut that night feeling kicked and maligned. Jerry had assured me he wasn't going to pull the Baron away from me, but I would have to find more horses and somewhere to live while I trained them. I sat up late, poring over my account books, wondering how I would come up with the money for Melton Pye, when I heard footsteps outside my hut. There was no bar on my door, and for a long moment I froze. Was it George Carsdale Luck coming to ask for the cash on hand? Was it Jock, ready to announce that he'd changed his mind about the divorce? My heart clutched and thundered in my chest.
"Hoody,"
a man's voice called from just outside.
"Karibu,"
I said, as I moved towards the door, still not recognizing the voice. I pushed open the thatch door and saw a tall, well-muscled warrior with his shuka gathered over one shoulder. A curved sword rested in a leather scabbard swung low on narrow hips. His hair was shorn close, but for one heavy plait that began at his forehead and cut over his clean scalp. His eyes were black and bottomless, and when I saw them, I wanted to cry. Arap Ruta had found me. He'd found me, even here. I looked at his bare feet, the plaited thongs tied around dusty ankles. He'd walked from Njoro, pointing himself at me the way you might throw a single arrow at several hundred square miles. For all of Kenya's vastness, it was incredibly difficult to disappear into, even if you wanted to. There were so few of us that we left trails as clear as smoke signals. That Ruta had managed to find me wasn't a surprise, but that he had wanted to. I thought he had forgotten me.
"I'm so happy to see you, Ruta. You look well. How is your family?"
"There has been cattle sickness at home."
He stepped into the patchy glow of my lantern.
"It's difficult to feed many on little or nothing."
"How awful," I told him. "Is there something I can do?"
"Everything has changed. There is no work. I thought you might have a job for me to do."
He'd been proud even as a boy. As a man, I guessed he was even more so, and that it hadn't been easy for him to come to me, asking for a favor.
"You're my oldest friend, Ruta. I would do anything I could to help, but I don't know if there is work just now."
He looked at me, trying to read my expression.
"Your father was happy to have me in his stables. I haven't forgotten what I know about horses, and I still ride well. I could sit anything once."
"Yes, I remember. Will you come in?" He nodded and brushed the dust from his feet, and then sat on a folding stool as I tried to explain. "Things have been difficult. One day there might be many horses to train, and plenty of money for everyone. But for now, I let my words trail away. I am patient. His eyes were clear and black and steady. When we win, you can pay me. But I don't know when that will be. The best chance I have is the Baron, at the produce stakes, 4 months away. I haven't begun to prove myself here yet.
I believe we can win, Mem Sahib.
You do? I couldn't help but smile. I've been doing it all alone, but the truth is, I don't know how much real faith I have anymore.
I've never seen you show fear. I am not afraid either. I will send for someone to bring my wife. She will cook for us.
It's a good plan, Ruta, but where will we put everyone?
We are serious and mean to win derbies. Surely room can be found.
I sat blinking, astonished by Ruta's optimism, and by how simple it all sounded coming from him. Nothing was simple, of course, but there was a striking symmetry in Ruta's turning up here. We both needed the other, very badly. That alone felt right. Perhaps we could win one day. Have some coffee. It's not very good, I'm afraid.
You never had a gift for cooking, he said, with a small smile.
No, I never did. At the tiny cedarwood table, I poured for us. He told me of his wife, Kimaru, and his 2-year-old son, Arsis. I explained that my marriage had ended, knowing he wouldn't understand or approve in the least. For the Kips, wives were treated as property, and the power balance was inimitably clear. Men were the heads of households, and their women respected this, and them, as law.
Bwana Purvis was not your father, he allowed, once I'd finished my story.
No, I said, nor yours. Ruta might never fully grasp the choices I'd made, but we didn't have to agree on everything to help each other. He had his own reasons for the long journey from the valley floor to my hut in Molo. You have no idea how much I've needed your help, my friend. I didn't know it myself until now.
I'm glad I've come. But tell me, is it always so cold here?
I'm afraid it is.
Then we will have to build a bigger fire, Beru.
We will, I said. We already have. Chapter 39. Only fearlessness would do now, and with Ruta by my side, I could finally remember what that felt like. I boldly beat the bushes for horses to train, and by early April had a bright chestnut, thick-shouldered stud named Rodigor, as well as the Baron. And I had Rack and Melton Pie back, too. The Carsdale Lux had sold them both to another owner who immediately trusted me a good deal more than they ever had. I was able to take them all with me when I left Molo for Nakuru, for this was how Ruta and I solved our housing dilemma. Molo was too cold and too forbidding, and so we made arrangements to lease space at the Nakuru racecourse, not far from Soysambu and territory I knew well. Ruta and his wife took over a small mud hut behind the main paddock. I had a bed on crates high up in the stands, under a tented metal roof. There was a bale of hay for my bedside table, another bale for a chair, and yet I was immediately happy and at home there. Life seemed livable again. Ruta and I had each other and a good race looming. What more was there? I was most excited about Rack. He'd had potential since the moment of his birth, perfect confirmation and the very best lineage. But potential could turn or spoil, or even dissolve. The final shadings of any racehorse's training were the most important strokes in the whole process. In a few months, I'd watched him grow from a willful and arrogant colt into something magnificent. Every muscle under his rippling chestnut coat spoke of power and grace. His legs were pistons and his body bright
He was built to run and to win, and he knew it. Rack was our ticket, Rooter's and mine. He would be the way we'd shoulder into this difficult world and make our mark.
One afternoon, a few weeks before the race meeting, I was in town sorting out a feed order and decided to drop in to Dee's hotel. It had been more than a year since the last time I was there, that traumatic night when Jock had gone for Dee and smashed him to pieces. It wouldn't have been hard to avoid the place altogether if I didn't want the memories or the chance of running into Dee, but I was finally feeling ready to face him again and see where we stood. I tied Pegasus outside, brushed off my moccasins, and swatted at my hair, wondering if I was even half presentable. Inside, it took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the light, but when I had my bearings, I saw that Dee wasn't in the room at all. But Dennis was, stretched out long in his chair with a drink, his dusty hat beside him. I think I stopped breathing.
"You look well, Beryl," he said, when I'd made my way towards him, only half feeling my feet. "How have you been?"
There was already too much history between us, too many difficult choices. Losses I might never have words for.
"Getting by," I managed to say. "What about you?"
"About fair."
He blinked his hazel eyes, and as I took in the fact of him, I felt my heart shudder and spin as it always had when he was near. Perhaps it always would.
"You were in London, I heard."
"Yes." I reached for the top of a chair to steady myself.
"I was away as well, for my mother's funeral."
"I'm so sorry, Dennis."
"It was her time, I suppose. Or maybe that's just what people say."
"And you're working now?"
"Yes. I took out my first professional client a few months back. A pretty good fellow. American, actually. He learned to use a machete and carried his own supplies."
"See?
I knew you could train all these spoiled Teddy Roosevelts to be reasonable." "I'm not so sure. Blix had one recently who insisted on bringing a piano along."
"Oh, Blix. I miss him." The words hung between us for a few moments, like filaments or webbing.
"How's Karen?"
"She's gone to Denmark to visit her mother, but by all reports she's well."
"Ah." I fell silent, reading his face again. It had a lot of sun, but under the healthy color, I could glimpse a hint of exhaustion. Or maybe it was worry.
"And Barclay?"
"Barclay's taken a bad turn, I'm afraid. He was stuck in bed at Soy Sambu for a month, when his heart nearly gave out there. The doctor told him not to move again, but he didn't listen."
"That sounds like Barclay. Where is he now?"
"At home. I don't know how much time he has."
"Barclay can't die. I won't allow it."
"Maybe you should tell him that soon, then."
I tried to force back my emotions while we rested in silence for a few minutes. Barclay would have to be fine somehow. And what of Dennis? Could we be friends again after all that had happened?
"Come out to Borgarni sometime," he said when I readied myself to leave. "I'll stand you a drink."
"I thought you said Karen's away."
"She is. You're always welcome, though."
"Oh," was all I could say. Then I stood and leaned into him for a moment, brushing his smooth-shaved skin with my lips. "Good night, Dennis." The next day, I rode to Solio, arriving near the cocktail hour. Knowing Barclay, I half expected him to be out in the yard, a bottle of champagne in each hand, but he was confined to bed. It broke my heart to see him there, frail and bloodless, small-looking as a child.
"Beryl, you angel,"
he said when I handed him a fat cigar I'd brought him from Nakuru.
"Light it for me, will you? I'm not sure I have the breath."
I didn't know how bad things were. I would have come before.
What do you mean?
He feigned. His colouring was so off, even his lovely teeth seemed grey. His voice was weak.
Do you know the farm has never been more profitable?
I'm just now getting the hang of things.
Just in time.
He tried to sit up, and I leaned over to help, gathering pillows to prop him up, while his Somali servants looked on severely.
They're not sure you should be touching me, he whispered. There aren't usually beautiful women in my bed.
I don't believe that for a second. You're a prince, Barclay. You really are the best of them.
Except for minor bits of me.
He gazed at the cigar I'd placed in his hand, the wraith-like curlicues of silvery smoke twisting higher before trailing away to nothing.
But I'll go out like the great poets, won't I? Full of fire and deep soundings.
Don't go at all, you rat. Please don't. He closed his eyes.
All right. Not today.
I found glasses for us, and he told me where to search out the very best wine, at the back of a cupboard near his bed.
It's Valernian, this bottle.
He held it up to the light.
It's one of the few wines that's got the stamp of the ancient Romans. Some think it's the best wine in the world.
You don't want to waste it on me, then?
Poor, beautiful Beryl. Are you sure you can't marry me? You could have my fortune when I die and raise scandals as my young widow.
Poor, beautiful Barclay. You always talk such a good game. But tell me, who truly has your heart?
Ah, that.
He coughed into his shirt cuff.
That's a very great secret.
Through dark-fringed lashes, his brown eyes had a soft fire about them, as if he already knew what waited for him. Past this life, into the next.
Grab a book and read something out to me, will you? I'm feeling lonely for verse.
I have something, I said quietly, and began to say out my Whitman lines from Song of Myself, the ones I had managed to keep close to me for years now. I didn't think I could look at him and go on, so I focused on his fine pale hands on the snow-white blanket, the pale blue moons low on his clipped fingernails, the small nicks of scars, the failing veins. When I'd finished, we sat quietly for a while. He swirled the wine in his glass.
It's the loveliest colour of amber, isn't it? Like lions in the grass.
Exactly like that.
Now, begin again. But more slowly this time. I don't want to miss anything.
I started again from the beginning, while his breath grew more and more quiet, his eyes softening, and then closing. There was a slight smile on his waxen lips, and his spiked lashes were like fragile ferns on his cheeks. How could I ever say goodbye?
I couldn't. I wouldn't.
But I kissed him before I left, tasting Falernian wine. Chapter 40. The long rains began, with towering storms moving through every few days. But the day of Barclay's funeral was startlingly clear. He wanted to be buried at home, on the banks of his river, which carried, he had always sworn, perfect glacier water all the way from Mount Kenya. Along a bend that curved like a woman's waist and hip, the river water sang over black basalt stones and riddled layers of peat. At that place, we watched Barclay go into the ground, while starlings and flycatchers rang bell-clear scales through the canopy.
Dozens of friends were there. Blix had come all the way from Somaliland and still wore inches of pale yellow dust on him. Dee's eyes looked somber under his curving sun helmet. But once the final words were said, and the earth mounded up over Barclay's coffin, he came to me and gripped my hands lightly and didn't let them go for a long time.
"I felt like a terrible shit for sending you away, you know," he said.
"You didn't have much of a choice," I said. "I saw that." He cleared his throat gruffly and shook his head, a long lock of his near-white hair leaping on his collar.
"If you ever need anything, I want you to come to me."
"You're still so young."
"I've forgotten that sometimes. When Florence and I were your age, we didn't have enough sense combined to scratch our own backsides."
He met my eyes, and I felt whatever was left of my humiliation rinse away. I had learned some hard lessons, but they had been important ones. "I will, Dee. Thank you." From Barclay's long shaded veranda, I heard the slow, melodic strains start up from the gramophone. Dennis stood over the flared cone and hissing needle, and Dee and I walked over together to join him.
"Don't you hate Beethoven?" Dee asked.
A faint pink blaze of feeling moved over Dennis's high cheekbones.
"Barclay doesn't."
We stayed for a long time, toasting Barclay's fineness and his life, lingering over every story of him we knew, until the sky thickened with grey clotted clouds and the light began to fail. When nearly everyone else had gone, Dennis said,
"Come back to Ngong with me."
"I have Pegasus."
"I can bring you back for him."
"All right," I answered, as if this happened all the time, and I wasn't crumbling inside, full of confusion and lingering hurt, disappointment and desire, all of it swirling riotously through me. On the drive we talked very little. The threatening sky finally opened properly, and a slow, constant equatorial rain began. It rinsed over the window glass and patted soft drums over the leather top. He didn't take my hand, didn't say a word about what he wanted, nor did I. There was so much unspoken terrain between us that we couldn't make our way to the simplest phrases. When we drew close to Karen's farm, he veered off the main road early, towards Bogathi, and I understood. He wouldn't be with me in her house, with her things looking on. That was their space together. We would have to make a place that was new and only ours. Dennis cut the engine, and we ran into the house, dripping, but it was wet there, too. More than a year had passed since my mother's strained visit, and if anything, the roof was even less reliable. The rain came in everywhere, and we ducked and dodged as we built a fire. It fretted and smoked, the wood damp. He searched out a bottle of good brandy, and we drank without glasses, passing the neck back and forth between us. Even with the rain and the hissing cedarwood in the hearth, I could hear us both breathing. "Why didn't Barclay ever marry?" I asked him.
"He did, in his way. There was a Somali woman in his household he was involved with for many years. They were devoted to one another."
"What? For years? And no one knew?"
"There's tolerance in the colony for certain things, but not for that."
It all made perfect sense now, how Barclay had kept his distance from the women in the colony, how coy he always was when I questioned him about romantic entanglements. It made me happy to know he'd had love in his life. But what had it cost him? How heavy was the secret he kept? "Do you think there'll ever be room in the world for that kind of attachment?" I asked.
"I'd like to think so," he said. "But the odds don't look very good."
When the brandy was nearly gone,
He led me to the small back bedroom and wordlessly peeled off my clothes, his lips on my eyelids, fingertips stroking the insides of my wrists. We lay down in a crush of warm limbs. He buried his face in my hair and neck, his movements so tender I could barely stand it. As desperate as I was for his nearness, I was haunted by the last time we were together, and all the days between. My heart galloped loudly. I worried it might burst. "I don't know what this is between us," I was able to say, finally. "Maybe we'll never have anything beyond this moment." I touched him, the cage of his ribs and chest rising and settling with his breathing. Our shadows painted the wall. "But I do care for you, Dennis." "I care for you too, Beryl. You're an extraordinary woman. Surely you know that." Part of me wanted to lay everything bare then, to tell the truth about London, to ask him about Karen, and just how he made sense of it all for himself. But in another way, I didn't believe anything would be solved by talking or explaining. We'd made our choices, separately and together, hadn't we? We were who we were. Coming to my knees, I traced the hollows of his collarbones, cupping shadows, his broad neck, and shoulders and forearms. I was memorizing him with my hands. "If you had another life to live," I asked him, "would you change anything?" "I don't know. Maybe our mistakes make us who we are." He fell quiet for a few minutes and then said, "The only thing I'm really afraid of is shrinking away from life. Not reaching for the thing, you know?" "I think so, yes." I rested my hand on his heart. Its soft drum sounded through my palm. It was true that many of the twists and turns that had led me to this room had been painful and costly. And yet I hadn't ever felt more fully alive. I was terrified, but I didn't want to run from him. I wouldn't. Not if I could help it. "Dennis?" "Hmm?" "I'm glad we're here now." "Yes," he said against my lips, while above us the rain thundered on. The whole roof could have come down on our heads for all I cared. I was in Dennis's arms. I would happily have drowned. Chapter 41. From the first trumpets to the roar and release of the grandstand, races are quick and ephemeral things. 10 horses galloping with everything they have in them. 1.75 miles, no time at all, and yet enough time, curled and poised and expanding like breath, for the race to be won and lost many times over. At the produce stakes, Rack went like the wind, and like pure, unfettered courage, thundering out in front the whole way. I kept him in my glasses, afraid to look away for even a moment. Ruta stood beside me, as still as a prayer, while the lead was stolen from Rack, 1 hair's breadth at a time. He never relinquished anything, never stopped pulling. But at the tape, a quick-boned gelding took it, and I finally breathed, deflated. "Did you see how close it was?" Ruta said, when the dust cleared, and my heart had started again. "The next time he runs, Rack will remember this and give more." "I don't think it works that way for horses, Ruta." I was trying to collect myself, thinking of next time too, if Rack's owner, Ogilvy, would let us have him again. "Why not?" "I don't know. They don't have memories like we do. Every race is new for them." But when we went to Ogilvy, he was far more inclined to side with Ruta. "Did you see how close that was? He'll win next time." And he did. For the remainder of 1925, my horses won and placed often enough
so that Nairobi's close-knit racing world finally seemed ready to let me in, and to believe I belonged there. Dee asked me back to Soi Sambu, telling me, whether it was now or later, there would always be a place for me in his stables. Ben Birkbeck wrote to say he was keen to give me horses, and that I appeared to be on track to take over my father's reputation in the colony. At one of my events, I spotted my mother in a towering feathered hat cheering me on. I hadn't seen her for over a year, and felt a jolt, stinging and complex. I still didn't know who she was in my life, or how to be anywhere near her, without feeling waylaid. Maybe I never would. "It makes me proud to see you doing so well," she said, when she searched me out afterwards. "Congratulations!" I watched her sip at a carnation pink cocktail and listened to her news. She was living up near Eldoret with Dickie and the boys, and trying to find some way to help Dickie make ends meet, but having very little luck. "I'm sorry things are difficult," I told her, and was surprised to find I actually meant it. Maybe Barclay had been right about family. Maybe we never survived them, or anyone we love. Not in the truest way. My feelings for Clara were tangled at the root, unresolvable. Whether I liked it or not, I would always carry the ghost of her leaving. But it also didn't seem right somehow to walk away and ignore her need. "Is there something I can do?" "We'll manage," she said, curiously stoic. She finished her drink and readied herself to leave, saying, "It is wonderful to see you're getting what you deserve." With my string of wins, I could finally begin to pay Ruta what he was worth, and pamper his wife with new shoes and cooking pots. I could buy a proper bed for my tent under the stands, too, and put away money for a car. But I wasn't going to rest on my efforts, or trust that the flush days would last. I felt the same way about Dennis. Every hour with him was sweet and stolen. I began to borrow a motorcycle of Karen's to visit him when he was at Borgani, and somehow the thrill of the motorbike beneath me, bouncing over the hard red dust, careening past deep potholes and stones, was like the sensation of being near him. Both were dangerous, both a bold and unforgivable form of trespass. Karen would have died a dozen times over to know I was at Bogarthi, under the holy roof, in her lover's arms, while she was away in Denmark, but I couldn't think of that, or of her. If I did, I couldn't have any of it, and that would be so much worse. Karen would be coming home soon, when Dennis began to talk of a scouting trip he was going to take near Meru. I knew he was really saying this might be our last chance to be together. "You could ride over and join me." There were logistics to sort out. I would ride to Solio, Barclay's old farm. I could leave Pegasus there, and we would go on together in Dennis's Hudson. When we returned, we'd be heading our separate ways. We were set to meet in February. In the meantime, he was going off on a long safari with a wealthy client from Australia, and I was working on getting Rack ready for the St. Ledger, Kenya's premier race. With his recent successes, Rack was the favorite, and I planned to put everything I had into making sure he would do all he was expected to, and more. On the afternoon I meant to head out to meet Dennis, the sky opened with a crack, and it began to rain as if it never planned to stop. Ruta looked out of the stable door at the sheets of grey water. "You'll stay then, Sabu?" He knew my plans. I kept no secrets from him, and never had. "No, I can't do that, but I'll delay. You don't approve of my being with Dennis. I know that." He shrugged and then sighed out a well-known native proverb. Who can understand? Women and the sky.
I love him, Ruta. After everything, I hadn't admitted this yet. Even to myself, somehow.
His inky eyes cut through the dense, pooling air and the drizzle.
Does it matter whether I approve or not? You will go to him anyway.
You're right. I will. All day I watched the rain and the rivulets of red running mud. Finally, when there was a small break on the horizon, and I was able to see paler clouds and a sheer hint of sunlight, I tacked Pegasus and made off. Solio was on the far side of the Aberdares, 35 miles straight east. Under perfect conditions, I would have spared Pegasus and ridden around the mountain to the north. As it was, I was making such a late start that I thought to shear off hours by heading over the top on a small, snaking trail. That I was on horseback alone in the middle of the night didn't frighten me. I'd ridden in the dark before, without half so much provocation. Pegasus could get me there. He had always had wonderful instincts in the hills, as sure on his hoofs as a mountain goat. At first we made good time. The weather had cleared, and the night air felt good on my skin. As the narrow route dog-legged upwards, climbing steadily, town lights were sprinkled here and there beneath us. Merchants slept in cramped beds, and children bundled on the floor on cane mats, snug and sound. I could scarcely begin to imagine that kind of quiet life with Dennis. Neither one of us was cut out for sameness or routine, the pinchings of domesticity. But there was this night, and the next one. Pirated kisses. Sweet and terrifying happiness. To have even one more hour in his arms, I knew I would do almost anything. We were perhaps halfway to Solio, when I began to smell water. Soon I could hear the river, too, just ahead. Pegasus and I approached it slowly, having only a little moonlight to steer by. As we came nearer, I could see the swirling movement of the current, ghost shadows twisting and eddying. The banks were steep and sheer. There was no way even Pegasus would make it down safely. And then how deep would the river be? Could we swim or wade through? I couldn't even guess in the dark. We picked our way north instead, scouting the bank for a way across, and then doubled back to the south. Finally, I made out the faintest sketching of a bridge. As we came closer, I saw it was fashioned of bamboo and thick twisted rope, only a few feet across, the kind local tribes built and tended for their own use. I didn't know how strong it was, but these things usually held small carts and oxen. It would probably do. I dismounted and took his reins, and we began our descent, Pegasus sliding a little in the pebbled gravel. He whinnied, then startled. The bridge felt solid, but loose on its ropes, so that it swung under our movement. I had a swaying, seasick feeling, and knew Pegasus wasn't any happier. Yard by yard, we crossed it. I could hear the water roaring maybe 20 feet below. White foam shifted in the moonlight, looking alive, and darker water jumped, silvered on its edges. When I spotted the pale bank, I felt pure relief. I'd begun to have the feeling that we'd come too far, and were risking too much, but we were nearly there, nearly on solid ground. The ropes groaned, making a sawing and ripping sound, and then the bamboo began to snap. Pegasus dropped with a lurch. He cried out, falling, and for a moment I was sure I'd lost him. Then the bridge shuddered as he stopped. His legs had punched right through the bamboo bracings. He was up to his chest, the slats holding him, just. Below us, the river roiled
and sent up a terrible sound. I was probably in danger of crashing through myself, but I could only think of Pegasus and the mess I'd got him into. Thoroughbreds are as skittish as they come, but Pegasus had always had a wonderful head on him. He was brave and cool even then, fixing his great eyes on me in the dark, trusting me to find a way. Because he believed I could do it, I believed I could too, and started working on a plan. I had a rope tied to the saddle, which just might be long enough to pull him out if I could anchor it well. I felt the bridge give and twist like bedsprings as I inched forward, too aware of adrenaline and my own ragged breath. Finally, I reached the far bank and found a wattle tree wedged in well and angled into the side. It was a young tree, but it was all I had, and I hoped it would do. I worked my way back towards Pegasus, who waited with epic patience. I made a running knot across the bridge of his nose and another going round his head in a makeshift halter. The rope wouldn't work if it slipped off. My thought was only to anchor him until morning. There was no way he could clamber out of the slats, not without leverage, and it would be too dangerous to try on my own in the blackness. I could lose him, and I would never chance that. Just as I got the halter secured and the other end tied to the wattle tree, I leaned against his neck, resting. "This is going to make quite a story," I told him in the dark, his velvety ears coming forward, listening. Tying a wool blanket over my shoulders into a cape, I settled along his side for warmth. But just as I thought I might be able to snatch a little sleep, I heard the smacking of brush and a rumbling crash. A herd of elephants had got our scent and come around. Now they wheeled and thundered on the bank, terrifying Pegasus. I didn't know they wouldn't rattle the bridge to pieces with us on it. By instinct, I stood. Pegasus struggled, lunging against the slats, shifting his weight in a rolling motion. I was full of pure fear, thinking he'd crash through, but somehow he got one leg out, then two. He stretched for the bit of the bank he could reach, pulling forward as the bridge gave and shifted around us. It was like trying to walk on a raft of shifting toothpicks, or crumbling burnt sugar, or nothing at all. Somehow, like a hero, Pegasus gained his footing and pulled through the remaining slats. But we were at a terrible angle. His weight dropped down the bank behind him, steeply, and he was exhausted. The sandy loam gave like water, and I thought I might lose him anyway. The elephants weren't far off. I could hear them groaning their warnings, and the unmistakable trumpeting of a bull. Urging Pegasus on, I stood by the tree and grabbed the rope with both hands, wedging my full weight, bent in two, pulling with everything I had. Finally, we were both on the ridge. I could see deep lines cut into Pegasus's chest from the bamboo, and there were great strips of flesh torn from his legs. We were both lucky to be standing there, but we weren't safe yet. The elephants were still nearby, and heaven knew what else. Pegasus smelled like blood, and we were both tired. That made us an easy target for anything on the prowl. We would have to keep going. When we finally made it to Solio, it was nearly dawn. Barclay's loyal Somali servant still had run of the place until the family could find a buyer. They knew me, and though it was an ungodly hour, they welcomed me in and readied a dry stall for Pegasus. I carefully cleaned and bandaged his wounds and found they weren't as awful as I had feared. The slats had gouged shallow trenches into the skin of his chest and legs, but there were no signs of infection and no fresh blood. He would heal well, thank God. In the meantime, where was Dennis? Perhaps the rain had stalled him too?
I had no idea what conditions were like, and I hoped for the best as I settled down to sleep. When I woke a few hours later, I had coffee and a light breakfast, all the time keeping one ear cocked for the sounds of Dennis. He was coming in his noisy wagon. I would hear him half a mile away, and then we would be alone for 6 days. We'd never had anything near that much time, and I felt dizzy with the idea of his closeness, his smell, his hands, and his laughter. He would show me places and things he loved, and we would live right to the edges of every moment we had together. If only he would come. Finally, after lunch, I saw one of Dennis's Kikuyu boys come running up the road towards the house, loping steadily along as if he could run forever. My stomach lurched watching him, for I knew what he meant.
"Beda says he won't be coming, Sabu,"
the boy said when he reached me. He had likely covered 20 steep miles that day. His bare feet were thickly padded with leathery calluses. He wasn't winded.
"Not coming at all?"
"They found no ivory."
Dennis was still working then. His days didn't belong to him, and he couldn't have come if he'd wanted. That didn't mean I wasn't crushed. I watched as Barclay's man gave the boy water and food, and then watched him set out again after Dennis, heading fearlessly to the north, tracing the bend in the road. When he was finally out of sight, I felt my spirit sag. Pegasus and I could have died on that mountain in the dark, and for nothing. I wouldn't be seeing Dennis. We wouldn't have our days at all, and I had risked so much to get them, to be here. I was almost sick with it. I packed up my things and then threaded my way down to the river, to the site of Barclay's grave. Months had passed, and the mounded-up earth had begun to sink here and there. I groomed the plot with my hands and the tip of my boots, wanting to do something for him and to feel close to him again. Above me, a pair of starlings scissored the air, calling out to each other in an elaborate system of chits and replies. Iridescence bloomed along their chests and heads in jewel-like green and blue and copper. The leaves quaked around them, but the rest of the forest was still. "Oh, Barclay, I've got myself in deep this time," I said. "What am I going to do?" "Nothing." "Not even the birds," answered.
Chapter 42. When Karen returned from Denmark, I tried not to hear news of her, but that was impossible. Colony life was too narrow and too bent on exposing every turn and gambit. She'd been ill and in bed for a time. That year's coffee crop wasn't good, and her debts were mounting perilously. I'd also learned that Dennis had set off for Europe with almost no warning, but since he hadn't sent word to me directly, I didn't know why. I ran into Karen at the Mutega Club at the end of March. She was there having tea with Blix, and seeing them, I nearly fell on them both. That's how things were in the colony. You needed friends, no matter how complicated those ties were, or what they cost you.
"Beryl," Blix said, squeezing my shoulders, "everyone's talking about how your horses might just win everything. Wouldn't that be something?"
Karen and I kissed hello tentatively. She looked thinner. The skin around her eyes was drawn, and her cheekbones were hollowed with shadows.
"Dennis has gone back to London," she said almost immediately,
as if she couldn't keep her mind on anything else.
"We had 2 weeks. 2 weeks together after 11 months apart. And yet I'm supposed to be grateful. I'm supposed to be brave and carry on."
Part of me wanted to shout yes at her, loud and strong.
she'd had a long string of days alone with him, when my time with Dennis had been stolen outright. And yet I also knew the grief she felt. I had it too. Now he'd left the continent again.
Why London this time?
His father is fading. He and his brothers will need to find a buyer for Haverholm. The estate has been in Dennis's family for several hundred years. I can't imagine how difficult this will be for them all.
She shook her head, and short curls tumbled. Her shingle had grown out roughly.
I know I should be thinking only of Dennis's family at a time like this, but I want him home.
Blix coughed lightly, a warning or reminder.
You're tired of hearing this song, I know, she snapped. But what am I supposed to do? Honestly, bro, what?
I could see that he wasn't going to tangle with her if he didn't have to.
Excuse me, he pushed back his chair. I've spotted a friend on the other side of the room.
When Blix had gone, Karen sighed deeply.
I finally agreed to give him a divorce. You'd think he'd be more grateful.
Why now? He's been asking for years, hasn't he?
I don't know. I started to feel terrible about fighting so hard to hold him. I've just wanted someone. Don't you see? There was a time I thought Dennis would marry me. But that seems a fool's scheme, more and more.
I swallowed to steady my voice, determined to appear at ease with her. Will things be more difficult on the farm now, with Blix moving on?
What do you mean with money?
She laughed darkly.
Braw has always managed to spend twice what's in his purse. Then he asks for another loan. As if I actually have it.
I'm sorry. You deserve more.
I suppose part of me knew what I was getting into with him. Maybe we always know.
She made a soft clucking noise, as if swallowing air or a movable fact.
Braw was never any good at feelings, but Dennis isn't any better, God help me. What can I do? He's ruined me for life without him. That's the thing of it.
The color must have rinsed from my face as she talked. I was losing the battle with normalcy, and found it hard to balance my cup or quieten my hands.
He always seems so happy to be on the farm. Why wouldn't he be? He only comes when he wants to come. It never costs him anything. My struggles matter, yes, but they're not his.
She was speaking of commitment. She wanted all of him, and for life. But she seemed not to understand how this would be a stranglehold for Dennis. She couldn't force a promise. He would have to enter her life freely, or not at all. After what I'd been through with Jock, Dennis and I very much agreed on this.
Why do you keep trying? Because when he's here, I'm happier than at any other time. It makes everything else endurable. I'll walk across the lawn and hear music from his gramophone, or come through my door and see his hat on the peg, and my heart lurches to life. All the other times, I'm sleeping.
You feel very much alive to me.
Only because you don't know me, not the way Dennis does.
I sat and listened to Karen's sad, beautiful words, wanting to hate her, her good chairs and carpets, her rare white lilies and face powder and overdramatic coal. She was wrong for trying to keep Dennis on a chain. But didn't I want him to? We were kindred in this respect, closer than sisters, and irrevocably estranged at the same time. Before I left the hotel, I found Blix at the bar to say goodbye.
How are you really? He asked.
Something in his tone was more delicate than I'd ever heard him be.
Still standing.
I straightened my shoulders for him so he would worry less about me. You know, Cocky was a lifesaver to me in London.
She's a wonderful girl.
She's marvelous. If you don't marry her, I will.